Hey, it's time for Truth About Markets, 104.4 FM in London. Lady.
Yes, we're in London. What's going on? I see you have actually newspapers all cut up there, ready to chat.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I was finally able to get some oatmeal this morning. You know, at Pret a Manger, because you can just walk in there and get food, unlike some of these other joints where you have to go in there and, you know, go. Anyway, so it's all about David Cameron and his critique of Edward Snowden. He was at the EU summit. Of course, it's been revealed that the U.S. has been spying on the U.K. and Angela Merkel and Spain and Italy. And Cameron, you know, true to type, was trying to pretend as if you talk about it a little bit.
So, well, the news emerged this week from some of the latest Edward Snowden details that Glenn Greenwald has. And Glenn Greenwald published this in The Guardian, which is a memo from, I think, 2006, where the NSA is indeed spying on various world leaders, 35 of them, including Angela Merkel. This information came out that they have tapped or hacked in some way her cell phone. And of course, she's outraged. David Cameron is over there in Europe trying to tell everybody just be a lapdog like him, be a poodle like Tony Blair, and accept this. This is the way we are, but Caesar's minions, and this is acceptable.
Yeah, I mean, he's the one coming across like Lord Hee-Haw here, who he's putting out the propaganda line saying that. What Snowden is doing, and to an extent what the newspapers are doing, is helping him doing. This guy can't even talk. What he's is frankly signaling to people who mean to do us harm how to evade and avoid intelligence and surveillance. This is not going to make our world safer. Okay, now, first of all, what can you say? I mean, Cameron, I can't, unfortunately, on this show, I'm a bit stymied because we're you're not allowed to speak openly. But clearly, this is a joke.
Well, it's a joke because, of course, when they say people who mean to do us harm, what they really mean is, okay, on the one hand, they're using that to scare Americans because Americans, of course, are going to think of bearded guys in caves in Afghanistan like Osama bin Laden. But we know they don't use phones. We know they don't communicate via the internet. We know this for a fact. So who are they spying on? What they're spying on is corporate espionage, and that's emerged from the data regarding spying on Brazil and spying on Mexico. They're interested in their oil stuff.
All right. So I mean, contrast that with HSBC, right? They laundered money for Mexican drug cartel people. 60,000 people were beheaded last year, the last few years. Okay. HSBC is a UK bank. It comes under the province of David Cameron. So the question is, how many of the beheadings was David Cameron responsible for? That's the question. So who's the terrorist here? That's the question. So he's pointing the finger on Snowden, which is unconscionably stupid. That this man is a treasonous. He really needs to step down because he's putting British lives in danger. He's the one who's kowtowing to Bandar, who threatened to kill Brits in London. He's kowtowing to Bandar. I don't see how the British people allow a terrorist whose British blood is swimming in British blood to sit in number 10 Downing Street. I don't understand it unless they're the stupidest freaking idiot. Oh, that's right, they are. They can't even serve a bowl of oatmeal in this country.
That's how freaking stupid they are.
This is going to be a tough show because there was no oatmeal in the shop.
Well, that store is always the same. It's always these little Italian girls like, I don't know what's going on. I don't know what's going on. I used to go there, but not anymore because they're all, you know, it's all for tourists who stand around their thumbs up their sphincter looking at the freaks in Soho and they notice that the service is freaking terrible.
Okay. So this is, we're talking about the spying on Angela Merkel. And, you know, the information keeps on emerging about this spying. And notice that it's always nations and leaders of nations who pose a competitive threat to American oligopolies, duopolies, or monopolies. And it's not against people who or nations who actually don't pose any sort of competitive threat, though there are very few of them. So, again, that goes back to this fact that Max has discussed for years about this being just corporate espionage. That was the first instinct you had as soon as this NSA stuff was leaked by Edward Snowden.
Well, yeah, then there's this huge draining of wealth by the people who are spying using the NSA. Remember, we reported on a show a couple of years ago that the CIA hires themselves out to hedge funds. Okay, the CIA hires themselves out to hedge funds to spy on corporations, to spy on world leaders, to game the system, to manipulate markets. Now it turns out that the NSA is also spying on behalf of hedge funds. If you have enough money, you can hire the NSA. You can hire Barack Obama to kneel down on his knees and bark like a poodle and feed him dead fish. And he'll be like, ruff, 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 ruff. You know, you can hire David Cameron to shave his ass and walk backwards. Okay, that probably only costs you maybe 5,000 pounds. Okay, this guy gives rent boys a bad name. You could hire him to do anything. Crawl through a bucket of dog turds, and he would be, yes, yes, if it means I can help my masters at HSBC, I'll do it gladly.
Well, you mentioned hedge funds, and that's another big story this week, which is just remarkable. Because, of course, during the financial crisis, many liberals, progressives, you know, people who the sort who likes Bono and Bob Geldof and put a colored bracelet on their rubber bracelet on their wrists and think they've done something to save the world or do some hashtag, viral hashtag, because Stephen Fry tells them to. And then they feel like they've done something to defeat tyranny or, you know, a dictator somewhere. Well,
yeah, where is Stephen Fry? I mean, Stephen Fry is out there sticking his nose in, you know, the Olympics to support the gay rights movement, which is alive and well in Russia. It doesn't need Stephen Fry sticking his nose into it. Where is he on David Cameron, who's committed an open act of terrorist and treason for the British people? Where's Stephen Fry on that? Is he down in Soho somewhere, you know, rolling around in the gutter, getting, you know, contemplating his life again in this huge drama queen like way? When is he going to step up? When is he going to stop being an apologist for BP's eco-holocaust in the Gulf of Mexico? When is he going to stop being a BBC Lord Hee-Haw? When is this guy going to get a life?
He's in Soho, New York. He's doing a you know, Broadway production for the next 6 or 7 months.
He should just shut up, because he's not politically aware in any way whatsoever. He's a drama queen who, you know, gets overly worked up about matters that he knows absolutely nothing about. He should just STFU Stephen Fry, please. We've had enough of your drama queen.
Well, speaking of drama queens, also Russell Brand was in the news this week because he called for revolution. He said there would be revolution. Well, he said that on Newsnight. But the other story I was going to talk about, and we'll talk about before the show is over, is this co-op bank being taken over by hedge funds. So let's talk about drama queen number two, Russell Brand, and what he said on Newsnight to the drama queen host of the show, Jeremy Paxman.
Oh, right. Well, It was an interesting exchange, because Russell Brand is extremely talented, let's say, unlike Stephen Fry. I mean, Stephen Fry, 20, 30 years ago, you know, he you know, was a somewhat amusing character actor, but he doesn't really have any deep-rooted talent. Now, Russell Brand is genuinely a talented guy who can speak well. He's very articulate. And he brought up some, you know, the issues that the only thing I saw that came out of this Russell Brand-Paxman interview is that there's going to be a movement to introduce in Britain, as they have in other countries, the option when you're voting of none of the above. Okay. Other countries have the option of when you vote, you can select none of the above. And this is extremely important, because it gives an idea exactly how many people are completely dissatisfied with the voting process. You should also make voting definitely mandatory by law. Everyone should be mandatorily have to vote by law, but you should give them the option of none of the above. This way you can get a real good sense of what people are thinking out there, that of the 60 million or 35 million Brits that can vote, X number like the one party, this people like the other party, and these people don't choose none of the above. That's a very important number and statistic to have. So if that is the outcome of this interchange with Paxman, then I think that's a good one. As far as his, as he said on the show, he has no ideas about how to actually implement a revolution. I saw an article on Zero Hedge from somebody who was imploring that he take a look at Bitcoin, which, of course, is a correct way to go about bringing about a revolution. I mean, Bitcoin would revolutionize and is revolutionizing. Bitcoin will be revolutionizing economics in China and around the world, and Russell Brand will still be talking to Jeremy Paxman about this in a year from now. Without acknowledging the revolution that's going on right now. In other words, there is a revolution going on right now. So this is the thing that Russell Brand, I think, overlooked or missed, is that he failed to mention that there is a major revolution happening right now in the Bitcoin space, in the cryptocurrency space, that is fundamentally changing the power structure and the way everything is oriented toward each other. So, I mean, I don't know how long it's going to take for him to get around to talking about it. Maybe never.
Actually, Deloitte has a piece out on their website today about Bitcoin. They call it Currency 2.0, and they're basically saying it's revolutionary and that 5 years on, the fledgling currency is gaining traction. Stats for just one of the many available digital wallet applications shows over 3.5 million downloads. The value of Bitcoin has appreciated over 1,000% in the past year, and the platform network boasts more than twice the dedicated processing power than the top 500 supercomputers in the world combined. And that, like most revolutions, it says that though adoption is currently highest in US, UK, Germany, and China, it's the our police states and surveillance states and the regulatory framework there is trying to crack down on it. Whereas they said the emerging markets in Kenya, it's now linked up totally with M-Pesa. China is also huge, and the government is allowing people to build businesses and enterprises. So they're saying it's like a complete revolution, which will force Western banks to have to change their business model.
So the revolution is here. It's called Bitcoin. And we saw in Cyprus people responding to the seizures of bank accounts. And as a matter of fact, on today's show, Kaiser Report, we talked to somebody about how Greece should go Bitcoin or stop complaining. Because, in other words, the people in Greece who are complaining about what's happening to their economy, they have a solution right now. They should all start using Bitcoin, and therefore their purchasing power would be maintained, and they would have a way to keep their economic sovereignty. So it's clear then there, if they don't, as I say in the show, they don't choose this path, it's because they would prefer the misery of the current path. And a lot of people choose that path, and that would be their path. It's not as if they don't have another choice, because now we do have a choice. As of 2009, there has been a choice. We've covered it on our show since 2009, on all of our various shows. It's going to be happening. I mean, the people who are reluctant to buy into it today at $200 a Bitcoin will maybe take a look at it when it gets to 1,000 Bitcoin per Bitcoin, and will probably buy some when it reaches 10 to 20,000 per Bitcoin. They'll finally join the Bitcoin revolution. But my point is, why not join it today and get the benefit of this multi-thousand point appreciation? If you think your energy bill in the UK is going up by 9% a year and it's too high, how would you like a currency that's up 1,000% a year? Your energy cost has dropped by 98%. Would you rather have your energy costs drop by 98% or go up by 9%?
Yeah, and Bitcoin right now is what it was like 191 this morning. Yesterday it went to 187, down to 187. Somebody tweeted me saying it was crashing. And
but, well, this is, you know, every time it pulls back, people are going to be afraid to buy it because it's pulled back. And every time it goes higher, people are going to be afraid to buy it because it's too high. So those people won't be buying it until it gets to $10,000 a Bitcoin. But that's the same with stocks. It's the same with any market. It's just people, they don't, unfortunately, the reason Warren Buffett is one of the richest men in the world is that he loves when prices come down, that he says he loves it, of course. And anyone who's made any money in stock market ever has the same approach is that you want prices to come down because you want to buy things cheaply. You don't want prices to constantly go up and then not have the benefit of buying things at a lower price. The fundamentals for this are in place. It's going to $10,000 per Bitcoin minimum. That's the fundamental reality. So the question is, when do you want to start to participate in this, or do you prefer the pain?
Yes, Warren Buffett did say that he was interviewed and he about shriekers, basically, I call them, because you do see that on our website, maxkaiser.com. People will come there. Whenever silver or gold or Bitcoin fall, they come shrieking, ha ha, the price is down. I told you, it's a disaster. You know, even though the price is up, say, 1,000%, in this case of Bitcoin, over the year. But Warren Buffett, the most successful investor in history, he said that he tries to feel the shriek. He tries to understand what they're going on about, but he's always excited to buy more. If that's what he wants to accumulate, if he wants to accumulate Bitcoin and he sees the price go down, he goes, great, now I can get two Bitcoins instead of one.
I mean, if you understand what it is you're buying. I mean, the same case, I guess, is easier to explain in terms of silver, because silver... We said buy it at $5 an ounce. Okay, we said buy it all the way up $30, $40, $45 an ounce. It hit $49 an ounce. It pulled back to $20 an ounce. Now it's back to $23 an ounce. The fundamentals suggest silver, at a minimum, will trade $250 an ounce given the amount of money printing going on in the world. So the question is, so once again, anyone who's been following us for the last 4 or 5 years, they're sitting on profits in their silver because their average cost is below the current price. People who bought it a year ago in the 40s are sitting on paper losses that will be papered away within 6 to 9 months as the money printing, as you see Mark Carney just announced that he's going to expand the Bank of England's balance sheet from close to £4 trillion in debt to close to $10 trillion in pounds in debt. He's going to print another £5 trillion. He's going to print another £5 trillion as a way to, what he thinks, stimulate the economy. This will, of course, debase the British pound and will make gold and silver go higher. Those are the fundamental truths. Those are the facts. That's what's happening. So either A, you choose the path of being on the right side of this, or you choose the wrong path. That's your choice.
Well, speaking of the wrong choice, many people, even though we said not to, they all moved their money. That was the big campaign. Move your money campaign. And that was move your money from the likes of HSBC to the likes of Co-op Bank, which is part of the same exact financial and banking system that is in place now. Same exact pool of capital. And of course, this week, Co-op Bank has been taken over by the hedge funds.
Right, because Co-op Bank had a whole bunch of money in their vaults that the hedge funds wanted, so they took it. And the Move Your Money campaign, as we've said, during the entire Move Your Money campaign over the past 4 years, there's no place to move your money other than gold and silver. There's no banking institution in the world that is immune from all the ravages of the HSBCs, the Barclays, Lloyds, and RBS. There's no place to go. There is no bank that's anything different than any other bank. If it is, it'll soon be bought by a hedge fund, as we just saw with Co-op Bank. There's only gold, silver, and Bitcoin. That's the only place to put your money. And by putting your money in gold, silver, and Bitcoin, you A, help drive the price higher, therefore helping your net worth go higher. You're stealing back the money that they stole from you to begin with. And B, you're helping to facilitate the collapse of these institutions that are predatory monopolists and driving your economy into the ground. So you actually are doing something that is both self-enriching and helping to get rid of the cancer that is the British banking establishment. But for some reason, people feel like they need to move from to different deck chairs on the Titanic. They're like, oh, the Titanic is sinking. I think I'll move my chair from the deck number 3 to deck number 2. Wow, I feel a lot safer now. Woohoo!
Well, part of the reason why Co-op Bank collapsed was their merger with Britannia Bank, which was one of these savings and loan sort of credit union things that building societies, as they call them here, that the, you know, there was this whole wave right after Thatcher of people who were members of these building societies, taking the 2,000 pounds, selling out for the 2,000 pounds, threw the whole bank into like the cesspit of the mosh pit of the sort of banking we have, you know, speculative, derivative-based, hyper-speculation of property. It was all about property. But Britannia went had a huge portfolio of commercial loans, commercial mortgage loans. But, you know, business is no longer done in the UK, and there isn't really any sort of market for business properties. There's only for, you know, speculating on houses and selling them to various people around the world and speculating with each other. And then, so their commercial property portfolio collapsed. That's gone to nothing. And the bank has then collapsed.
Mm-hmm. Right. So the point is that there's no place to move your money other than gold and silver and Bitcoin. And by doing so, you're helping to create a revolution. You know, again, Russell Brand, this is another obvious idea that would help bring about a revolution or to continue the revolution that's already in place. But, you know, I think a couple of buzzwords that Russell Brand has that are hard to displace are this idea that we need to redistribute wealth. You know, he's part of a group of folks who would argue that there's too much wealth in one part of society. We need to redistribute that wealth. And which would mean that you need to go back and try to get a committee, a group of people that are either elected or appointed in some way to somehow manage to apportion wealth in a way that is societally acceptable. Now, unfortunately, that is impossible because humans have proven themselves uniquely unqualified to run an economy in that way. You know, maybe in other species they have examples of this. Maybe the squirrel community knows how to distribute nuts or something. But the humans, unfortunately, has been proven over and over and over again. When it comes to trying to divvy up wealth in the community, they are uniquely unqualified for that task. And it always, and as 100%, always resulted in disaster. So that brings us back to something else in nature that has worked for 5 million years, and that is called competition. Everyone is free to compete. And if you have a Bitcoin, your Bitcoin is now competing with pounds and other currencies that are controlled by psychopaths. You want the best currency you possibly can have, and therefore Bitcoin qualifies to be a competitive currency in that instance. And you are free then to compete for more Bitcoin for you and your family as you therefore go forward. You know, it's an idea that it's also... It's foolish to try to re-engineer humans to be somehow, oh, we're not going to compete anymore. We're just going to have a magical formula that allocates goods and services in a way that doesn't cause any friction whatsoever. I mean, you know, again, that goes against millions and millions of years of evolution. You know, look at the evolution of the human fist, for example. It's designed in such a way to impart 4 times more damage than it receives when throwing a punch. That's through millions of years of evolution. Is that because humans have been living in Shangri-La for millions of years in complete harmony with each other? No, it's because the struggle for life is always there from the beginning. And if you don't, see, unfortunately, people would prefer to be in prison or a slave and get a little food stamp from the state and whinge all day than to actually be a living, breathing human and have a life. You know, most people just hate life, unfortunately. It's the same thing in America, the same thing in the UK. There's a huge anti-life movement.
Well, the other thing about this whole redistribution concept that Russell Brand put out there is that it's that's like calling, you know, somebody breaks into your house, steals your stuff, the police find the person responsible, takes the stuff back from him, and gives it to you. Do you call that redistributing the guy's wealth to you? No, it's returning the stolen goods to you. Same with this banking story. You know, we don't need their wealth redistributed. We need our stolen wealth returned to us.
Yeah, well, that's the other major fallacy of people who talk about redistribution of wealth is that they fail to mention that we already live in a society where wealth is being redistributed. It's being redistributed upwards toward this kleptomaniac class of predatory bankers that's already existing. So once again, you know, it would be helpful if Russell Brand could incorporate into his rhetoric the fact that this is already going on, and it's going on in a very warped sense. But it also is the proof why it doesn't work, because anytime you create a system in which redistribution is somehow being managed in a way that is supposed to be elegant in its design, it's never, ever going to work. And we see that in the banking class right now. So it's just, you know, I mean, it made for an interesting I mean, for BBC, it was interesting because generally on the BBC, it would be the average age of the guests is 70. And they discuss things like when, you know, Glenn Greenwald was on the BBC and the comment from the ex-director of GCHQ from 20 or 30 years ago about spying. She made a reference to like a fax machine or, you know, a carrier pigeon. Or that means she had obviously she had no understanding whatsoever of technology post 1985. And yet she's the expert on the BBC talking to Glenn Greenwald, who's breaking the Edward Snowden story, which is saving lives. It saved Britain from going into Syria. How come there's not servicemen out there in Trafalgar Square getting on the ground and kissing the ground and praising Edward Snowden for saving their lives? Why is that? Oh, that's right. They picked the path toward easy death because they figured for some reason they'd rather have a pretty tombstone than some kind of viable life.
Well, part of that is people are used to this toll booth economy where going back to this Bitcoin and banking, our banking system now is they like the healthcare system. Everybody likes the toll booth guy. They like the middleman. I don't know why. They're more comfortable with it. They're comfortable with them taking their wealth and they don't want it redistributed back. They call that socialism. But there's another interesting story out of the U.S. this week in terms of this toll booth neo-feudal economy that a lot of people seem to like, and that is this: these private equity and hedge funds that own vast swathes of properties across the U.S., tens of thousands. They're buying up 10,000, 20,000, 70,000 homes at a time, all cash. So 65% of all homes sold last year in the United States were in cash. That compares to something like 30% before the housing market collapse. So all cash, but interestingly, when one rents from one of these bankers, as the Huffington Post revealed, well, there's almost no way to get any sort of service. So one guy, you know, owns a place and he rents it out, and you call this landlord and you tell him, hey, the water heater is broken, or, you know, there's rats in my house, and they sort it out. Well, apparently, these guys are just uncontactable, and there are people who have had backed up toilets for months on end, and they can't go in their house. They have to go to the supermarket down the road, things like this. And there's just no way to get in touch with any of these hedge funds or private equity groups.
Yeah, it's like trying to get in touch with Google or PayPal or something, where, you know, they put out the service, but they have no way to contact them. And if they lose a customer, they don't care because there's millions and millions and millions behind each customer. But yeah, so you've got these slumlords, and as we talked to Dr. Michael Hudson about on the show a couple of weeks ago, they caused the crash in subprime and the housing market. Millions of people lost their homes with illegal foreclosures, and of course, J.P. Morgan just paid, I think it was a $35 fine for that. And then now the hedge funds come in with all cash given to them at 0% interest from the central bank. Now people have to move into the house that they were illegally foreclosed on. They're paying through the nose for rent, which they don't have jobs because the job market's crashing for all the same reasons. And there's no landlord, so you end up in a FEMA camp or a prison camp, or basically it's just a huge prison. You know, America's becoming like Gaza, so it's just Gaza and Detroit, are joined at the hip basically. And you've got the Saudis and the Israelis and the British and the American kleptomaniac class who's just counting up their profits, and they don't really care.
Well, one thing you've often talked about in the prison industrial complex in America is that near these prisons in America, where there are millions of young men in these gulags across America, there's no hashtag for them. There's no Stephen Fry campaign for these guys. But around those prisons, the prison operators will also own the hotels and charge an exorbitant amount for, because they're out in the middle of nowhere, and they are able to charge the families that come to visit the inmates these a lot of money to visit their family. Well, with these rental units that these hedge funds and private equity own, there were a lot of them, of these families, had to continue paying rent, but the house or the property itself was uninhabitable, so they had to live in hotels nearby. So that's another scam for these guys to do.
Because they own the hotel as well. They own the hotel and the house that you can't live in. And it's like that story we reported a couple of weeks ago. There's a new class of prison where people pay to check into the prison.
Yeah.
So, and of course, if you can't afford it, the loans will be made available to you from Wonga or some other, you know, extortionist, gulag casino mafioso, and you can become an indentured servant, which is the goal.
Well, in case you didn't see the episode of the Kaiser Report where we talked about that, so in America, there's many places in California, for example, some communities are earning income by renting out spaces in their jails, in their smaller prisons that are safer, not overridden by gangs. So they'll charge like $200 a night, where you can have a higher chance of not being raped or you know, involved in a gang knifing or something like that. So you could see exactly where this is going,
right,
of course.
Right. I mean, they advertise like, come visit Sing Sing, Nebraska, chance of getting raped, less than 10%. And TripAdvisor, people who stayed here, only less than 10% got raped. So that's why we can charge $200 a night. And, of course, when you don't pay your bill because you got fired because Walmart family is siphoning all your cash, you just go down the block to the real prison, the next prison, and then you will definitely get raped. It'll be on video and pay-per-view, and somebody can watch it live on their internet connection at the BlackRock headquarters or the Berkshire Hathaway headquarters or Jamie Dimon's headquarters. You know, it's already been proven that the SEC got busted 2 years ago. They're all watching porn all day. That's gay porn or prison porn that they're watching from people who are being raped in the homes owned by BlackRock, owned by JP Morgan, owned by Wells Fargo. So they're watching pornography of these people getting raped in the homes that they foreclosed them on, that they had to go back into because they couldn't afford not to stay anywhere else. So it's all about rape-o-vision.
Yeah. And of course, it's part of the whole penal system, is part of the Justice Department system. And in the United States, you know, again, Stephen Fry never talks about this, but they, the U.S. Department of Justice has something like a 99% success rate. And you know why they have a 99% success rate in prosecutions? Well, because most people accept a plea bargain, because what they do is they say, like to Aaron Swartz, they did this. Aaron Swartz, we're going to sentence you. You're going to do 60, 70, 80 years in prison unless you plead guilty and take 2 or 3 years. And then that's, most people take the 3 years instead of the 90, and they get a 99% success rate.
Right. And of course, let's say Corrections Corps of America, which is the biggest prison operator in America, private prison operator, and they've privatized the prisons. They cut deals with municipalities that guarantee them 98% occupancy in their prisons if they do the deal of absorbing the cost of running the prison in that state. So then the police are told, look, we got to fill the prison because that's our contract with the prison. So they go out and they arrest people, whether they're guilty or not, or whether they're engaged in crime or not. They throw them in prison. And now they plea bargain with them. And they say, look, you know, either we're going to give you 50 years in prison on a trumped up charge you just pulled out of our butthole, or accept 2 years in prison. You say, okay, I'll take 2 years in prison. Now Corrections Corps of America, the prison operator owned by the same people who own all the tract housing in the same country, they get their cut. The hedge fund gets their cut. And you know, you're doing your bit because now you're in prison getting raped, which is your sole responsibility in this economy, whether you're in Britain or in America.
There's another interesting trend. Part of this whole prison industrial complex in America and surveillance state complex in America is you linked to this story about this guy in somewhere in the South, and he tried to hire a guy who he thought was with the KKK to kill his black neighbor because he couldn't stand him. He was dirty or something like that. He used some racist language. But if you read the facts of the story, it's quite alarming. in that, in light of this NSA sort of surveillance and this whole thought crime stuff starting to happen, is he found out this black guy was living next door to him, and he looked up online and found that he was had sex crimes in his past. Right, the guy had been charged with rape or something like that. So this white guy became convinced that the guy had raped his wife, and shot at the guy, shot near his feet, and the guy ran away. And he found that to be a sign of the guy's guilt, that if he had not raped his wife, he would have stood in his ground.
Right.
But what happened is somehow the FBI found out about this and contacted the guy posing as the KKK and asked them if he wanted him, as the KKK guy, to kill his black neighbor. So they contacted him after learning about this story. And the guy said, yeah, kill him. I'll give you like $100 if you kill him. Mm-hmm. And so, like, why is the FBI, like, it's everything is entrapment now in the U.S. Because, of course, they want them in this profitable prison industrial complex. Because if you can't afford one of these private equity rental units, then they want you in one of these prison industrial complex rape units where they could sell on the videos to the people trapped inside the private equity owned rental units.
Right. And, of course, all the... all the cases of so-called terrorism that the FBI or the NSA has stopped since 9/11, they've now all, without exception, have been proved to be similar entrapments. So the CIA or the NSA, they find a mentally deranged person. They say, hey, would you like to blow up that building for a bag of rock candy? And the guy goes, and then the FBI writes in and says, see, we caught another terrorist. We caught another terrorist. And then they get
keep funding us.
Send us another $1 trillion because we're fighting terrorism. And then Edward Snowden blows the whistle and says, look, these guys are the terrorists. Cameron, Obama, they're your terrorists. HSBC, they're the terrorists. He makes that very clear with thousands and thousands and thousands of irrefutable documents. So what does Cameron do? He says, he's a guy. Wait a minute. My script prompting machine attached to my iPhone that's shoved up my sphincter is tickling me right now to give me the right words to say. Stephen Fry, is that you, Stephen Fry? Oh no, I what's my script supposed to be?
That was Max Kaiser's rendition of Stephen Fry on crack.
Well, it's just, I mean, David Cameron, I mean, everyone at the EU summit laughed at him because, you know, he is the joke of Europe now. Remember last year he was saying that we don't want anyone regulating our banking industry because it's the growth of our country and we don't want to get involved in you stinky European bankers. You know, I mean, everyone laughed at that because the City of London is the world's banking cesspool where there's no regulation at all. And now he's making this claim. I don't remember ever a UK leader as pathetic as this one. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm not a big history buff in UK history, but at least Thatcher had a pair of balls. I mean, this guy is really a wondrously ineffective eunuch who parades around the world stage mouthing whatever gibberish is texted to him from the CIA, and now everyone knows it.
Oh, by the way, there was a kind of two amusing stories in the Times today that we read while out at the cafe, and that was that. So here, you know, Edward Snowden essentially stopped the invasion of Syria, the revelations there. So Syria. Northern Syria, they're saying Al-Qaeda is establishing a caliphate. Okay? You British people, your soldiers, we're going to go in there to help establish this caliphate, essentially. The other thing was in Iran, because of the softening of relations with the U.S., the hardliners are going over the top, and they've introduced a sort of reality TV show sort of concept is that they're looking for the most anti-American artwork, and you can win £2,500. So I don't know if you know Brits are allowed to enter this, but there's a Down with Satan sort of artwork they're looking for.
Yeah, I mean, nobody you know has been talking about the fact that leading up to the invasion of Syria, Cameron and Bush, what is that? No, Obama, were supporting Al Qaeda.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, remember all the British soldiers died in Iraq fighting Al Qaeda. Well, that was a big joke. Your lives are worth nothing because your government decided that Al Qaeda is really, they made a mistake. It's like if you go to the hospital to have, you know, your appendix removed and they cut off your left leg. You know, they you're supposed to just thank the hospital for that wonderful procedure. They did it really well, but even though that wasn't the operation you wanted. So here you are, a UK serviceman, a Marine or some helicopter pilot. You're being asked to go fight Al Qaeda in Iraq. Your comrades are dead. And then 6 months later, the government says, oh, we made a mistake. Al Qaeda is actually our friends. They're our allies. So I guess, again, the path you've chosen is quite foolish, I would say.
Well, Al Qaeda was only in Iraq because America brought them there. And the Al Qaeda in Syria is only armed because we brought the weapons in. The CIA brought the weapons in via Benghazi. So they're, yeah. Well, that's part of that prison industrial complex sort of mentality, the military industrial complex mentality. You need some sort of sense that the other guys are fighting back. That's why the FBI does all these entrapment things. They look for mentally unstable people and, you know, sell them, here's a bag of rock candy, go blow up that building. And the mentally unstable person does it because they finally had somebody, some human contact, somebody actually spoke to them. Some guy actually spoke to me and they do this. But it helps scare those people trapped in these homes in private equity land. You know, it gives them a sense of like there's scary people out there. I'd rather pay this private equity land slumlord than be out there where all these scary people are, and they'll support it. But so this is part of that whole sort of thing. They arm the bad guys because the bad guys don't have any weapons otherwise. So they need them to actually fight back occasionally.
Yeah.
In order to sell the war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, so it all comes back. You know, circle around, and the revolution, but it is happening with Bitcoin. Whoever created it in 2009, you know, said the banking system was beyond repair. It's too corrupt to fix. So they released the Bitcoin protocol, and it's starting now to make serious inroads into the global economy. The Chinese folks who are quite concerned about the dollar and the crash in the dollar and the value of the dollar are now pouring into Bitcoin. I think the propaganda here is so thick that the average British person really won't get into Bitcoin until it's well over $10,000 a Bitcoin. So that's unfortunate. There will be a few, though, who bought silver at $5 when we said to buy silver at $5. We told people on this show to buy gold when it was 100 pounds an ounce. Now it got over 850. Touched 1,000 pounds an ounce. A lot of people, we get emails all the time thanking us for that. We did tell people to buy Bitcoin at 5. It's now at 200. So there's a few people out there who are benefiting from this, but the vast majority will be just strung along by their nose and fed into the meat grinder that is the atrocity of David Cameron's government.
Well, David Cameron's government, so they're in the news. Okay, so this week we've had in the energy market, this is a big story here because, of course, more and more of these, the six energy companies that control all energy supply in the UK, everybody's raising their prices by 9-10%. And David Cameron has said that he's going to cut green energy taxes. He's going to roll back the taxes, and that's going to somehow reduce the cost of energy. Well, you know, so-called green energy taxes aren't actually all that much. They're not 10% of the bill, like the price rises that are needed in order to sustain the shareholder buybacks and the dividends and the, you know, the CEOs of these energy oligopolies having to make 20, 30 million pounds a year to be the middlemen. So what do you think of what the energy, this the oligopoly story about the energy supply here in the UK?
Well, it's a function of what we're saying over there at the Bank of England. Bank of England expanded their debts from £800 billion at the 2008 to close to £4 trillion. They wanted to bring it up to £10 trillion, according to Mark Carney. That means that your value, the purchasing power of your pound, is going to drop like a stone. So it takes more pounds to buy the same unit of energy. But, of course, this doesn't affect everyone in the same way, because if you're in the banking class, the money that Carney is printing, this £10 trillion, goes to them first. They then loan it out 10 or 20 times and get a fee on that fractional reserve loan. So they're making 50 to 60 times more than the price of energy is going up. So they're making money. Even though the price of energy is going up, they're still making more than that rate of inflation. If you're just an average person out there working an average job, by the time the money gets to you, it's debased the pound so much so that now that 9% rise in energy costs is actually reducing your quality of life. Your standard of living is dropping as a result of this money printing, because you're paying a lot for energy and food now suddenly. And, of course, wages are not going up more than wages are up less than 1% a year. So, again, this is what we call the financial apartheid. If you live on one side of the wall, you get first crack at the money printing, and then you lend it out 10 or 50 or 60 times and get a fee. If you live on the other side of the apartheid wall, suddenly your wages are not going up, but your energy costs are up 9, 10%. So quality of your life is dropping like a stone. So it's apartheid. It's a ghetto. They're creating a ghetto. You're in the ghetto. It's going to get worse. No amount of money printing will ever get you out of the ghetto. It'll only make you worse. Money printing for you equals deflation. Money printing for them equals inflation. They get wealthy on the money printing. You get poorer. That's the apartheid wall. That's the divide in society. It's not race. It's not color. It's not religion. It's all about the apartheid wall of interest rates controlled by the Bank of England and Mark Carney, who just gave you the big FU. He said, all you people suffering out there, you're going to suffer a lot more because we're going to print another £5 trillion. That's what he said to the banking committee this past week. We're going to take the balance sheet of the Bank of England from £4 trillion to £10 trillion. That means your purchasing power is going to drop, your wages will continue to drop, and your quality of life will continue to erode. And guess what? They're going to blame you. The rhetoric's already been teed up. They'll say, the problem is you. You're not working hard enough. You're a benefits queen. You're a dosser. Which is what they, quite frankly, this is the same tricks they use to put millions and millions of people in jail under Nazi Germany. They're claiming that they were less than, they were subhuman. They should end up in jail. And this is coming your way now for the exact same reason, the exact same people. These are the same bankers. J.P. Morgan financed the Nazis famously, and so did Walt Disney and Henry Ford. Who do you think runs the Britain? So anyway.
So let's talk about the Bank of England story. What Mark Carney has announced this week, just as, of course, they're saying, oh, the economy is booming, GDP is up. Well, of course, they neglect to mention that debt is up far more than GDP, which is why the Bank of England is having to expand its balance sheet. And what they've done is, up until now, so as part of this quantitative easing, the banks are allowed to sell their assets, i.e. their debts, their books of portfolios of debt, to the central bank, and the central bank gives them in return cash, gilts, the highest quality, allegedly.
Print money.
Yeah, they print money. So however, the Bank of England has always, up until this week, demanded the highest quality of debts. So like AAA rated sovereign debt and stuff like that. But now they're going to take mortgage-backed securities. The same thing, for example, that you mentioned J.P. Morgan paying this $13 billion fine. $4 billion of it is just, relief for homeowners. So that's basically nothing. So it's only $8 billion that they're actually paying. And that they're going to get a 50%. Like, it's all being tax write-off anyway. So, the reason why J.P. Morgan is paying that, the headline rate of $13 billion is because of mortgage-backed securities. They were all fraudulent. They sold them to Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and other investors, and they all went bust down to zero, nothing. So they've paid this fine. Now, Mark Carney is willing to accept those same exact products, the same exact products, which, by the way, also blew up Co-op Bank. So the Bank of England is going to start swapping 100 cents on the dollar, 100 cents on the pound, 100 pence on the pound for those.
Yeah, the UK already had the highest debt to GDP of any country in the world. It was 900% if you include national debt, bank debt, personal debt, corporate debt. Now, under Mark Carney's scheme, that number is going to go to 1,500% debt to GDP. Not even Iceland, before it blew up, at 1,000% debt to GDP, ever reached this incredible level. It all works. The Ponzi scheme works as long as interest rates in the UK remain at these low levels. Remember, Carney said with his, quote, forward guidance, interest rates will remain low. Yes, of course they will remain low for the same reason that a Ponzi scheme must always accept new money to keep it going. Once the money stops, the Ponzi scheme collapses. We saw it in 2008. There was a moment when the Ponzi scheme was interrupted. Bernie Madoff famously went out of business, and so did almost every other bank go out of business. Why did Bernie Madoff and all these banks go out of business at the same time? Because they're all operating a Ponzi scheme. His was the one that got sacrificed. The other ones were given money from the government. Why wasn't Bernie Madoff given a bailout from the Federal Reserve Bank? What he was doing was no different than what Citibank, Bank of America, or HSB were doing. They're all operating Ponzi schemes, but unfortunately he did not get a bailout because he was not a friend of Hank Paulson. So he was sacrificed. So was Lehman Brothers. So was Bear Stearns. They had a few sacrificial lambs, but the insiders were floated. Now, here we are in 2013. The Ponzi scheme was on the verge of cracking again. So they're going to break open the balance sheet by trillions of more pounds, which means that the apartheid is going to get worse. Your purchasing power is going to collapse. Your energy prices, we have already seen them skyrocketing. That's due to money printing. Don't believe the hype. It has nothing to do with, well, energy prices are set on world markets and we have nothing to do with it. That's a lie. It all has to do with your central banker and the total lack of competition in the UK. And so it's going to get a lot worse here.
Well, I also want to bring up another story that just broke on Twitter last night. And that is, next week on Have I Got News For You, Kirstie Young hosts with U.S. political pundit Max Kaiser and comedian Mr. Tony Law, joining panelists Paul and Ian at Hat Trick Productions. So, it appears, according to Twitter, that Max Kaiser, the U.S. political pundit, the most outrageous political pundit in America, is going to be on Have I Got News For You.
That's right. I can confirm that. According to the information I have, that is correct. That's true. I'm going to be on that show next week. We tape Thursday, and it airs on Friday.
Yeah, they record for quite a bit of time, and then they cut it down to 20 minutes.
It's only a half-hour show, and by the time it gets on the air, right, they tape for an hour and a half. So my total screen time will be probably 3 minutes or less. I mean, you think about it. There's 26 minutes airs. There's five people that are on the show, including the host. And so, you know, I end up on the air for 3 minutes. So this seems like a big snooze to me because I'm just going to be sitting there for an hour and a half. You know, maybe I'll say one or two things that make the cut that are amusing. But, you know, I mean, it should be fun. And then we're going to Amsterdam immediately after that for a weekend. But, it could be fun. I'm looking forward to meeting these people. I've watched the show. I think, you know, Paul Merton, I've seen him. He's a funny guy. Ian Islop is, I read The Private Eye sometimes. You know, he's a funny guy. So should be fun.
And by the way, a final note on this Bitcoin. So Silk Road, I guess is, the Dread Pirate Roberts, he had $28 million. They found his Bitcoin wallet. I guess it was on his computer. He didn't have a brain wallet. And so they've taken his $28 million worth, which is, I don't know how many Bitcoins they actually said they have. But, well, this could be good news for the community, because if the feds do sell those, we do know there's huge demand. Like, people the environment, the Bitcoin environment is expanding so rapidly and people want to do business. So the more liquidity there is in the system right now, those Dread Pirate Roberts seems not to have been circulating those Bitcoins. So if these are put back into the community and all the Chinese and the Kenyans and people can actually have access to more of these Bitcoins, we could see more liquidity, more transactions happening.
Yep. Yeah, I guess they hacked, they found his password and they got his Bitcoins. Just like if you leave your wallet somewhere and somebody finds it, they can steal your money. They did not hack into his account. They simply found where he stores it in the password, and they stole his money. Again, you know, it's okay for HSBC to be involved in money laundering and drug dealing with the CIA, and tens of thousands of murders can be the result. But that's, you know, on the right side of the apartheid wall. This guy was on the wrong side of the apartheid wall, so he's quote unquote guilty of something.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so in total, I think they've said they've seized $33 million from him and his site, which is like, I mean, that's more than some of these banks have paid for defrauding and, well, collapsing the entire global financial system and defrauding millions and billions and also, you know, throwing a lot of people into an early grave.
Yep, that's right. So it's, again, it's the central banks, Mark Carney, you know, the Bank of England is becoming the global toxic waste dump of risk. So all the countries around the world, like, for example, JP Morgan, they need to pay this fine, a $5 billion fine. They'll finance that with Mark Carney. So they'll swap with Mark Carney and the Bank of England. They'll swap for $5 billion to pay the fine. They'll swap with him, let's say, a bag of dog poop. And Mark Carney will gladly accept that bag of dog poop and say that it's a AAA-rated credit worth $5 billion in gilt. And they'll send him right over to Jamie, who'll pay off his fine. And the Bank of England will be having in its inventory, in its basement, a big bag of dog poop from Jamie Dimon. And they'll say at the end of the quarter that our balance sheet is worth 7 trillion, 8 trillion, 9 trillion pounds, and it's all good bona fide collateral that can be sold at any moment for 100 cents on the dollar. Even this bag of dog poop that we sold, that we took in exchange for $5 billion from Jamie Dimon, that's worth $5 billion, 100 cents on the dollar, any day of the week, 24/7, no questions asked. And that'll go on until the Chinese or somebody says enough is enough. They declare we've got 5,000-6,000 tons of gold. We're divorcing ourselves from the dollar, and these fiat currencies go the way of the dodo. And then everyone will say, well, why don't we go to the Bank of England and take some of the money out there that they took in exchange for the collateral swap? And they'll say, well, the only thing we got here is a bag of dog poop. I don't think that's going to float this trillion, multi-trillion dollar British economy. Oops. And then Mark Carney will be gone. He left Canada. He ended up in Britain. At that point, when they discover that Mark Carney is the Bernie Madoff now of Britain, and that he's been engaging in a massive Ponzi scheme, and that he's swapping dog poop for gilt, he'll be in some other country, probably in the third world somewhere. He'll take over the Zimbabwe Central Bank with his little coiffed hairdo and shiny buttons and his little screeching wife who can't find adequate housing. And he'll go rape some other country. But for now, Britain's got him.
Okay, and that's it for this episode of The Truth About Markets on Resonance 104.4 FM.
Bye, y'all!